This week on America Interrupted from the PBS NewsHour. Amid the chaos of the pandemic, protests following another police shooting of a black man, devastating wildfires and hurricanes, President Trump accepted his party's nomination at a Republican National Convention like no other. So how did the president defend his record and make the case for another 4 years? And were Republicans able to energize Trump's base while also winning over voters on the fence? Listen and subscribe to America Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Outrage, peaceful protests with sparks of violence in a few cities and confrontations with police. We explore the racial reckoning in the United States. Then, election threats. Members of Congress raise the alarm after the Director of National Intelligence cancels in-person briefings on voting interference. And health care in America. We visit Houston to examine the stark and widening disparities in access to medical treatment in the U.S.
Houston represents both what is the best of American health care and really what is the worst. You have parts of Harris County, which is where Houston is, where life expectancy is lower than what you see in many third world countries.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. A political battle is intensifying tonight over protests against racial injustice and incidents of violence. Amna Nawaz will focus in a moment on what's happening with some of the armed civilian groups and the role of police. But first, White House correspondent Yamiche Alcindor reports on how the presidential candidates addressed it today.
Amid a weekend of largely peaceful protests, dueling messages on who bears the blame for outbursts of violence. In Pittsburgh today, Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden pointed at President Trump.
This president long ago forfeited any moral leadership in this country. He can't stop the violence because for years he's fomented it.
After the speech, President Trump tweeted, quote, "To me, he's blaming the police far more than he's blaming the rioters." White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany said Democrats are at fault.
When the Trump administration arrives in a Democrat-run city engulfed in chaos, peace is restored, law and order is upheld.
The vast majority of nationwide demonstrations sparked by the killing of George Floyd in May have not turned violent, but incidents of shootings, property damage, and looting have ignited debates over how authorities should respond and whether demonstrators on both sides have gone too far. President Trump has attacked the efforts of local Democratic officials. In scores of tweets this weekend, he keyed in on new clashes in Portland, Oregon. The city has seen nearly 100 days of protests against police violence. It began Saturday when supporters of the president drove through the city in a 600-vehicle caravan rally. They were met by counter-protesters along the route, and some of the president's supporters fired paintball guns into the crowds. That led to clashes, which were eventually broken up by the police. After the caravan left, a backer of the right-wing group Patriot Prayer was shot and killed. It's unclear if the rally and the shooting are related, and the gunman has not yet been pinpointed. Sunday night, police arrested at least 29 people in separate demonstrations, and today Oregon State Police returned to Portland. Sunday, the city's Democratic mayor accused the president of fomenting unrest.
Mr. President, why this is the first time in decades that America has seen this level of violence? It's you who have created the hate and the division.
President Trump defended his supporters on Twitter, and this morning he again threatened federal intervention, writing, quote, "If this joke of a mayor doesn't clean it up, we will go in and do it for them." Meanwhile, in Kenosha, Wisconsin, tensions remained high ahead of the planned presidential visit tomorrow. On Saturday, roughly 1,000 people peacefully marched in the streets to protest the shooting of Jacob Blake by Kenosha police. Last Sunday, an officer shot Blake 7 times in the back. His family says he's now paralyzed. At the march, his father demanded the officers involved be held accountable.
My nature is to protect my son, to stand up for my son when he cannot stand up.
President Trump has criticized the local response to the protests in Kenosha, which has seen some violence. On Tuesday night, Kyle Rittenhouse, a 17-year-old, showed up to the protests with a long gun. He claimed to be protecting businesses. He was later charged with shooting three people, killing two. As Kenosha copes with the unrest, the city's mayor and Wisconsin's governor, Tony Evers, both Democrats, urged the president not to come. In a letter to President Trump on Sunday, Evers wrote, quote, "I am concerned your presence will only hinder our healing." Today, the president tweeted that his visit will go ahead. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Yamiche Alcindor.
For a closer look at the protests and those armed groups showing up in response, we turn now to Mary McCord. She's legal director at the Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection. She's also a law professor at Georgetown University and formerly with the Department of Justice as acting assistant attorney general for national security. Mary McCord, welcome back to the NewsHour and thanks for being here. We should mention it's been 14 weeks now since George Floyd was killed. And as was just reported, in the hundreds of protests since then, they've been overwhelmingly peaceful, but things have taken a turn, as we saw in Portland and in Kenosha, now much more deadly in some instances. Do we know, very briefly, do we know why that is?
Well, I think there's a lot of different contributing factors, but certainly the violence we saw recently in Kenosha was at least in large part attributable to the private militias that took it upon themselves to do what they called protecting property, but they did so without any authority. They came heavily armed. They weren't answerable to governmental entities or to really anyone other than themselves, and they created a permissive environment where others, including the 17-year-old, who may or may not have actually been officially part of any of the militias that came, but nevertheless was a hanger-on, they created this permissive environment that resulted in tragedy. And I think we've seen more and more across the country at peaceful protests, at protests against racial injustice, we've seen more and more of these self-proclaimed and self-professed militias showing up ostensibly to protect property, but with no authority, heightening tensions, intimidating people, and sometimes resulting in violence like we saw in Kenosha, Albuquerque, Portland, and elsewhere.
And I want to ask you, Mary, specifically about a couple of those cities. But before we move on, I want to ask you about the word militia, because there's been a lot of question about why we use this term to refer mainly to groups of armed white men, but rarely armed black men or any other group. Do you know why that is?
Well, I can't tell you, you know, whether it had any sort of racial basis. Militias, the term, goes back, of course, to the founding of the country, and at that time referred to all sort of able-bodied white men, frankly, between certain ages. It didn't include white in it, but that's who predominantly the landowning people were in the country at the time. And so I think it has historical roots. But militias have never been, private militias have never been lawful. To the extent militias have ever been lawful, they are only in service of the state or the federal government. So they can only be called forth by the state or the federal government. As you indicated, you know, when we talk oftentimes about people of color having armed groups, other terms might be used for those groups, including terms like gangs. So I think what has devolved over the course of time is something that does tend to break down somewhat racially. And I would also add that the militia groups, they fancy themselves as patriots and suggest that what they're doing is actually in furtherance of the Constitution when it really is nothing of the sort.
So, Mary, the groups in Kenosha, for example, will argue that they're protected under the Second Amendment to be there and armed and help protect the community. What do you say to that?
Well, the Supreme Court has actually been quite clear back in 1886 and as recently as 2008 that the Second Amendment protects an individual right to bear arms for one's own individual self-protection, but does not prevent states from prohibiting private paramilitary organizations. And that's what those groups were. They were private paramilitary organizations. The Second Amendment doesn't protect their activity in Kenosha or elsewhere.
So if they're not supposed to be there, whose job is it to enforce that they are not there and not armed in the way that they are?
Mm-hmm. Well, there certainly are state authorities that could enforce that. And state law in Wisconsin prohibits, not only does the state constitution prohibit rogue militias, rogue militaries that aren't answerable to the governor, but it also prohibits falsely assuming the functions of a public official. And so when those militias were essentially arrogating to themselves law enforcement responsibility, the responsibility for protecting property, they were falsely undertaking the functions of law enforcement that they have no authority to undertake.
So when you look at what happened in Portland, for example, the protesters will say they have the right to peaceably assemble. So will the Trump supporters who drove through in those caravans. Who is to stop it before it gets to a violent, potentially deadly clash?
This may require cities and maybe even with the help of the state and even the federal government, if necessary, to actually enforce the types of time, place, and manner restrictions that are permissible under the Constitution in order to allow for peaceful protests. That means things like not allowing militias, not allowing violence, not allowing firearms where it's possible to ban them. So those are the kind of things that law enforcement and government officials need to be able to enforce, although it's very difficult given the spontaneity of some of the protest activity that we've seen.
And given that tensions also keep rising. That is Mary McCord of the Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection. Thank you very much, Mary.
Thank you.
In the day's other news, the Trump administration's new COVID-19 advisor says Americans should feel cautiously optimistic. Dr. Scott Atlas, who came on board this month, says infections and deaths are declining in hard-hit states, and there's no need to fear, even as more schools reopen. Confirmed cases nationwide topped 6 million today, with 183,000 U.S. deaths. A federal appeals court in Washington has refused to end the criminal case against Michael Flynn. The former national security advisor pled guilty to lying about contacts with Russia before President Trump took office. But the Justice Department had moved to dismiss the case. The appeals court also tossed a congressional lawsuit to make former White House counsel Don McGahn testify. House Democrats say they plan to appeal. In Lebanon, lawmakers endorsed diplomat Mustafa Adib as prime minister, designate today. The largest Sunni party, the Shiite Hezbollah, and Christian blocs all backed him in a rare display of unity. Today, Adib visited neighborhoods recovering from a devastating Beirut port explosion. He promised accountability.
Words fail to describe this horrific scene. We will try, as soon as the government is formed, to speed up the investigations and to have the investigations result given to the public as soon as possible.
Lebanon has also been rocked by protests over government failures as the country's economy crumbles. The first commercial flight from Israel to the United Arab Emirates landed there today, now that they have normalized relations. Emirati, Israeli, and American flags waved after the plane arrived in Abu Dhabi, with officials on hand, including Jared Kushner, President Trump's son-in-law and advisor. Back in this country, thousands of people in Louisiana are still waiting for power to return after Hurricane Laura. The extent of the damage crystallized this weekend as evacuated residents went home. Estimates for insured losses are now nearing $9 billion. The storm killed at least 18 people. In economic news, Delta, American, and United Airlines have now all abolished fees for changing domestic travel plans, hoping to get people flying again. And on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 223 points today to close at 28,430. The Nasdaq rose nearly 80 points to an all-time high, and the S&P 500 slipped 7, but had its best August since 1986, adding 7%. And Hall of Fame college basketball coach John Thompson has died. He made Georgetown University a national champion and was outspoken about matters of race. Jeffrey Brown looks at his life.
Georgetown will finish the year.
John Thompson Jr. made history that day in 1984, becoming the first black head coach to win an NCAA title. He was known for transforming Georgetown into a powerhouse and molding basketball greats like Patrick Ewing and Allen Iverson both on and off the court.
Coach Thompson, was saving my life. No other schools were recruiting me anymore. My mom went to Georgetown and begged him to give me a chance. And he did.
Thompson saw his own role as going beyond basketball.
I could use it to open a doorway for myself or for other people. It was an educational instrument for me.
Thompson made a point of recruiting black athletes to the predominantly white campus and spoke out about injustices he saw. In 1989, he famously walked off the court before a game to protest an NCAA scholarship rule he felt would hurt disadvantaged students.
Because of the success we were having as a basketball coach, and me being an African-American, I had an obligation to say something about it, so I did.
The NCAA ultimately modified the rule. John Thompson coached at Georgetown for 27 seasons and won almost 600 games. He was 78 years old. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Americans will begin casting ballots in this fall's general elections in just a couple of weeks, and Election Day itself is just a little more than 2 months away. But now there is word of changes in how top U.S. intelligence officials will brief Congress about other nations' attempts to interfere in the election. For more on that, I'm joined by our own Lisa Desjardins and Nick Schifrin. So hello to both of you. Lisa, first of all, tell us a little more about what is happening and why this matters.
Speaking to many sources today, both parties are very concerned about threats to election security this year coming from foreign adversaries. And I have learned there was scheduled a briefing for the House Intelligence Committee in mid-September. But Friday, John Ratcliffe, the Director of National Intelligence, sent a letter to both chambers of Congress, saying that all briefings in person would be canceled. This led to a confusing back and forth for the next 24 hours about what exactly he meant. And now it seems sources are telling me the understanding, this is coming largely from Republicans, is that now Republican senators will be briefed, but not House Democrats. So just to review, here's what we're talking about. As a co-equal branch of government, these are the two committees that usually are fully briefed. House Intelligence, led by Democrat Adam Schiff, and Senate Intelligence, now led by Republican Marco Rubio. The change duty, as we understand it right now, is that only the Senate Republican Intelligence Committee, only the Senate Intelligence Committee, both parties on that committee, will be briefed fully in person. Everyone else will get written statements. Okay, so why does this matter? First of all, briefings provide a great deal more information in person than on paper. Separately, this shows the mistrust that is growing between lawmakers who usually put politics aside on this issue. And it's coming at an important time, Judy. There are real concerns right now about Russia in particular attempting to manipulate this election. And as one Senator Angus King pointed out to me today on a phone call, there is a feeling that in 2016, the public was warned too late about what Russia was doing. And there is concern that, again, the public may not be aware of what is going on right now.
And Nick, what is the intelligence community saying about this?
Judy, an ODNI official told me that, quote, they are committed to meet their statutory responsibilities to keep Congress informed, but they wouldn't confirm what Lisa just reported about whether there will be some in-person briefings to either the Senate or the House Intelligence Committees. As for the motivation, they're very clear. Those letters that Lisa just mentioned were sent to congressional leadership and committees on Friday, and Ratcliffe wrote that he didn't want information, quote, misunderstood or politicized. He told Fox News that that meant he didn't want to see information leaked.
We've had a pandemic of information being leaked out of the intelligence community, and I'm going to take the measures to make sure that that stops.
I asked Ratcliffe's office about leaking. All they would say is that we take unauthorized disclosures of classified information seriously.
And to add to that, Judy, I asked lawmakers also, and Senate Republicans could not pinpoint a specific example of a leak that came from Democrats that they thought was a problem. Instead, they said it's a general politicization of intelligence. Democrats push back. They think that they're being penalized for being too aggressive or more aggressive on this issue. And some Democrats do believe, as Nick just reported, that this action could be illegal.
And Nick, finally, you've been talking to former intelligence officials. What are they saying?
Yeah, these former officials, Republicans, Democrats, senior career intelligence officials, they accuse Ratcliffe of misleading the public on the threat to the election. In that Fox News interview, he insisted that China was the U.S.'s top threat. And many officials across the government do believe that China is the long-term strategic threat that the U.S. is most concerned about. But the immediate, the overt threat to the election is Russia. And that was even in a recent statement released by the Office Director of National Intelligence. It said pro-Kremlin actors were trying to denigrate former Vice President Biden and boost President Trump's candidacy, whereas China's goal was long-term, shape the policy environment, pressure political figures considered anti-China, and deflect criticism. And that really leads to former officials' fear of the politicization of the intelligence community. First, Ambassador Rick Grenell, a Trump ally with no intelligence experience, became acting director. And now John Ratcliffe, nominated and withdrawn last year, also a Trump ally with no intelligence experience, confirmed a few months ago. And now former officials tell me that senior career intelligence officials are leaving the intelligence community for fear it's being politicized.
And all this happening just weeks before the election, before people start voting. Nick Schifrin, Lisa Desjardins, thank you both. In Belarus, thousands of protesters marked President Alexander Lukashenko's birthday yesterday with a derisive chant of "Happy Birthday, Psychopath." This is after a week in which the government's security forces furthered their crackdown on protesters and journalists. In partnership with the Pulitzer Center, here is special correspondent Simon Ostrovsky in Minsk.
The embattled leader's birthday was all jeering, not cheering, Sunday. Even still, demonstrators did bring gifts, a funeral wreath and a coffin. One man marked the day dressed as the angel of death.
Despite intimidation and threats, the Belarusian people have continued to protest. And this is exactly what the authorities here don't want you to see, because over the last week, they've arrested dozens of journalists. Many have had their credentials revoked, and many have been sent out of the country altogether.
Belarus ordered a sweeping crackdown on the media in the lead-up to Sunday's march. These were the scenes last week when some 50 journalists were taken into custody as they covered demonstrations in the capital, Minsk. 19 reporters were stripped of their government press cards, the foreigners among them expelled, according to the Belarus Press Club. Arrests of ordinary rally-goers also continued. A video shared on social media depicts the moment a protester attempting to escape police was dragged off of a bus. In all, close to 500 people were detained last week, according to Belarus's Interior Ministry. It's all part of Lukashenko's struggle to hold on to power after he declared himself the winner of an August 9th presidential election rejected as a fraud by the opposition, the U.S., and the EU. One major power has, however, offered Lukashenko assistance.
I asked the Russians to give me three teams of journalists from the most advanced TV. We're not paying for these Russians at all.
According to the closest estimates, each new day of illegal protests costs Belarusians from $10 to $20 million.
The change in tone on Belarusian state television hasn't gone unnoticed by ordinary viewers.
The style of propaganda has been changed. Before that, it was much more primitive, and now it became more subtle. We don't want some foreigners to brainwash our people.
One example of that subtle change, the main state broadcaster no longer ignores the very obvious countrywide opposition rallies. Instead, it presents demonstrators either as paid foreign agents or useful idiots with little understanding of why they came out to protest.
This week, alternative rallies also took place. Not so well attended during the working week, but they did happen, and to ignore them wouldn't be right.
Opposition protesters have gone to extraordinary lengths to protect the few independent reporters that dare to cover the protests. At a women's march on Saturday, demonstrators prevented security officers in plainclothes from detaining a man with a camera who they had tried to pull from the crowd. It was a very different atmosphere at one of the smaller pro-regime rallies the authorities have hastily thrown together in response to the three-week-old protest movement.
The goal of the protests is to come to power and then tear us away from Russia. We can't let that happen.
Riot police were nowhere to be seen, and television crews and photographers could operate openly. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Simon Ostrovsky in Minsk.
This global pandemic has again driven home the crucial role that our healthcare system plays in our health and our well-being. And tonight, we begin a special series about how we provide healthcare in America, compared with how it's done elsewhere in the world. William Brangham and producer Jason Kane filmed this series in the weeks before the pandemic broke out. And William joins me now to explain a little more about the series. So, hi, William. I know you two work very hard on this. Tell us a little about what the series covers.
Well, as you said, Judy, we started this before the pandemic broke out. And the idea was to look at the state of American healthcare, how it is today. And as you know, this is a country with remarkable innovation in that field, remarkable innovation. And yet this is also a country with incredibly stark disparities. There's over 30 million people who have no health insurance whatsoever. And so we thought, can we learn something from other nations that do a better job of covering everybody? And there's obviously a political side to this. We saw a big debate going on in the Democratic primary. We know this is going to be a big issue in the presidential campaign. Vice President Biden wants to expand the Affordable Care Act and get us closer to universal coverage. President Trump says he wants to get rid of the ACA and replace it with something better and to lower costs. But we thought, since there are so many nations that are already doing a very good job of this, let's go there and see how they're doing it.
So inevitably, as you say, it is going to be a part of the campaign. Where did you go to make these comparisons?
Well, we went to three countries that provide good, inexpensive, universal health care to their people. And there's been this debate happening in this country about, is health care actually a right? These are nations that are not having that debate. They are just doing it for their citizens. And the key metrics that we looked at here are access, quality, cost, and how they take care of the disadvantaged in their societies. And the U.S., frankly, doesn't do that well on a lot of those metrics. So we went to several nations, three in particular, the United Kingdom, Switzerland, and Australia, all of which measure better. And we wanted to see, how do they do it? Let's look at exactly the mechanics of how they get there.
And as you say, you were filming before the pandemic broke out, but of course, since then, it's become a huge public health concern. How did you look at how these countries are dealing with that?
Well, initially, we are not looking at that. We really wanted to stay focused on this issue of universal care, in part also because the way these countries responded to the coronavirus pandemic is only partly influenced by the structure of their healthcare systems. I should say, at the end of this series, we will have a conversation very specifically about how they responded to COVID, but we really wanted to stay focused on, how is it that these countries are able to cover everyone at seemingly a reasonable cost, and what might we learn from that experience? And so for that, we begin our story here in the U.S. in Houston, Texas.
This is a boy saved by American innovation, a bouncing, rocking, joyful testament to the miracles of modern American medicine. His life was transformed here in what's called the largest medical city in the world, the Texas Medical Center in Houston. Here, doctors test artificial organs built from scratch. Technicians design robots to speed efficiency. Surgeons use virtual reality reconstruction to see tumors inside the body before ever making an incision. And kids like 6-year-old Kaysen Cox come back from near death. Kaysen was born with only half his heart functioning normally, the hints of blue in his skin, a sign of a little body hungry for oxygen. Most kids with this condition don't live very long.
I can remember it perfectly. It was pouring rain outside, of course, and I was by myself, and my doctor told me that she sees that Kaysen's heart is underdeveloped. It was a very few dark days for me.
But in 2017, using a new and highly complex surgical technique at the Texas Medical Center's Children's Memorial Hermann Hospital, Dr. Jorge Salazar changed the course of Kaysen's life.
Kaysen was going to die, and had we done what we've always done, he would have had a transplant already, or it's a hard thing to say, but he would have passed away already. But now we have a normal child in front of us.
Dr. Salazar came out with the biggest smile on his face, and he said, "I did it, you did it, he did it, and it worked." So, I think we all started crying.
You got it?
Kaysen Cox is one story. The Texas Medical Center performs 180,000 surgeries every year. And it, like other gold standard medical centers across the U.S., draw hundreds of thousands of patients from around the world. The technologies and innovations created in the U.S. also get exported globally.
You see what your options are around here. You
just but passed, just a few miles away, it's a world apart. In North Houston, the mostly low-income residents here experience a very different healthcare story.
I want you to see that within just a few miles, you have the very best and the very worst. And
it's Elena Marks is the president and CEO of the Episcopal Health Foundation. They analyzed CDC data that revealed incredibly stark inequalities here.
They don't know a discharge date right now.
The mostly black residents here are disproportionately uninsured, and they often don't get care until it's too late. They die, on average, 20 years earlier than residents in other parts of Houston.
You know, the deck's stacked against you. If you could get to the medical center, that would be great, but you'd probably be really sick because of the neighborhood you live in by the time you get there.
The U.S. spends more than $3.5 trillion on healthcare every year. It's nearly a fifth of our economy. As a percentage of GDP, that's almost twice what most developed nations spend. We spend more than all these nations combined. And yet Americans still die of preventable and treatable diseases at higher rates than in other high-income countries. Ours has been called the most expensive, least effective healthcare system in the modern world. Lack of health insurance, or the high cost of healthcare, is a huge barrier for millions. In one recent poll, more than 1 in 3 people said they skipped medical treatment because of money. That includes people with health insurance. And last year, more than 30 million Americans, about 9% of the country, had no health insurance at all. Since the pandemic, an estimated 3 million more joined their ranks. For many years, Houston resident Lakeisha Parker was among the uninsured. She was a certified nursing assistant.
I was proud of that work. I enjoyed doing it because I love to be able to help people. So what I would do is go into people's homes after their surgeries or illnesses and assist them with getting back to life, daily activities of living, bathing, fixing them a small meal,
going to get their work.
It is very intimate work.
But Parker says the pay wasn't great. She says the most she ever earned was about $13 an hour, and it never came with health insurance she could afford.
I'm actually working in healthcare and can't afford to pay it. That's not right.
Texas has the highest uninsured rate in the nation. Roughly 18% of Texans, 5 million people, don't have insurance. And the state didn't expand Medicaid, which would insure more low-income Texans under the Affordable Care Act. So, like many, Parker went for years without checkups or seeing a regular doctor. Too expensive, she said. But then she discovered a lump the size of a tangerine in her breast. It was malignant cancer.
All right, relax your arm for me. I'll put this in your
Parker found this Houston clinic that would treat her on a sliding scale based on her income. Only after the cancer diagnosis did she qualify for a special Medicaid program, so the tumor, along with 33 lymph nodes, were removed. While surgery was a success, it, along with the chemotherapy and radiation, left her unable to use one of her arms like before.
Okay, not bad. Okay. Let me feel underneath your arm.
Sure.
Do you think if you had had insurance, you would have found this sooner? You would have been going to the doctor sooner?
If I would have had insurance for me at that time, healthcare that I would have been able to afford, I would have easily accepted it. But again, it comes the question of having somewhere to live, having something to eat, gas to get back and forth to work. So, you know.
Those were the choices you were wrestling with?
Of course. You know, those are everyday life choices that a lot of people have to make based on their income.
The weakness in her arm cost her her job. With no money, she lost her apartment.
And you become homeless if you cannot pay rent. It's
a hard thing. Parker is now homeless, unemployed, and at the time of our interview, living in a shelter.
Houston represents both what is the best of American healthcare and really what is the worst of American healthcare. You have parts of Harris County, which is where Houston is, where life expectancy is lower than what you see in many third world countries.
Dr. Ashish Jha, who's now the dean of Brown University's School of Public Health, traveled with us for this series. He says that the seeming choice between medical innovation and universal coverage is a false one.
I reject that dichotomy as somehow we have to have 20-25% of people uninsured if we're going to have a really highly innovative healthcare system. There are many reasons to reject that. So take a state like Massachusetts, where I live. It's also very dynamic, incredible new innovations happening. And yet pretty much everybody in Massachusetts is covered.
How do we wrestle with this idea that we're in a place with this incredible level of innovation and technological advancement, and yet we are seeing these disparities in healthcare? What is causing those horrible end of the numbers?
So the disparities we see are driven some by high costs. Of course, if healthcare spending was cheaper, it would allow us to cover more people. But there's also a bunch of political choices we've made. We've just decided as a society, not everybody's decided this, but many political leaders have, that it's okay to have people die from totally preventable, totally treatable diseases because we're not going to cover them. That's a political choice. Of course, I think that's a terrible political choice. We can cover everybody in America without bankrupting the country, without creating long wait times. But we have to decide that we're going to do that.
For our next three programs, we travel to the United Kingdom, to Switzerland, and to Australia to look at how they get to universal coverage and what the U.S. might learn.
How's Spider-Man jump?
So that America can both embrace its innovation.
It makes me feel good just to know that he is getting this life that he deserves.
And address its disparities.
We are still citizens. We pay taxes. It makes me feel that we don't matter.
So those two worlds don't remain so far apart. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm William Brangham in Houston, Texas.
And a quick postscript to William's report. Lakeisha Parker has a new job at Amazon. It has benefits, and she will soon be moving into her own apartment. Both President Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden are hitting the campaign trail in person this week, each of them delivering remarks on, among other things, racial tension and violence in some American cities. Our Politics Monday team is here now to analyze each party's message. That's Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report and the host of Public Radio's Politics with Amy Walter, and Tamara Keith of NPR. She also co-hosts the NPR Politics Podcast. Hello to both of you. Good to see you. After 2 weeks of conventions, I want to start with what Joe Biden and the president are saying about violence and the source of it. But Tam, I want to start with something the president said just moments ago at a briefing at the White House. He was asked about the teenager, Kyle Rittenhouse, in Kenosha, Wisconsin, who just a few days ago shot and killed two Black Lives Matter protesters in the aftermath of the the shooting of Jacob Blake. And here is what the president said in answer to a question about Mr. Rittenhouse.
He fell, and then they very violently attacked him. And it was something that we're looking at right now, and it's under investigation.
So, Tam, in essence, the president defending what Kyle Rittenhouse has done. He was a 17-year-old carrying a long gun, and the president is saying it was in self-defense, in essence.
That is what the president is saying. You know, President Trump has this tendency to, when there are people who support him or are sort of ideologically aligned with him, he is very quick to defend them, see the best in them, look for reasons that they may not be guilty. And of course, this is, we live in a system where you are innocent until proven guilty, obviously, and this is an alleged crime at this point. But President Trump was much more quick to blame people on the left for violence in other cities, including the shooting death of a right-wing activist who was part of a caravan in support of President Trump in Portland over the weekend. So this is part of a longstanding pattern that President Trump has, where he has difficulty finding the right words, or whatever you want to call it, condemning violence that is ideologically aligned with him. And he has a much easier time condemning violence that is not ideologically aligned with him.
So, Amy, when the president talks about things like this, when he says the Democrats are going to bring lawlessness, violence to American streets, what voters is he trying to reach?
Well, it's interesting that this is where we are right now, Judy. It sort of fits actually into what Joe Biden was saying today. He was out in Western Pennsylvania pushing back on charges that were raised during the convention by the president and by a lot of Republicans that were on the convention stage, that Joe Biden would, bringing Joe Biden into the White House would unleash this wave of violence in the cities. And Biden said, essentially, wait, do you feel safe right now? Talking not just about the violence, but exactly what Tam raised here, which is when the president has an opportunity to lower the temperature, he raises it. When he has a chance to like calm the waters, he just roils them. And this is what you've been hearing from voters over and over again, these voters that now the president is going after, whether we're calling them suburban voters or women voters, who have said time and time again, while they may like the message, right, we don't want violence, we don't want to see our cities turned into this vigilante sort of justice, at the same time, they don't see the president as having the temperament to be able to deal with this.
And I mean, Tam, when you think about how Joe Biden is now coming back, he's saying the president is the one who's created the conditions for this violence. He's created an atmosphere of chaos. Does the White House have an answer? Does the Trump campaign have an answer for that?
Well, President Trump was given an opportunity today. He was asked, do you want armed militias going into cities, or do you want law enforcement to handle this? And he said, well, you know, I want law enforcement. And then he started about going after Democrats for the idea of defunding the police. The campaign response, they had a call today, sort of a prebuttal to the Biden campaign speech. And here's a quote from someone who was a surrogate for President Trump. This person said, in Trump's America, this will stop. There's a little bit of cognitive dissonance because this is Trump's America. What the president and the campaign and the White House will say is, in places where they accept the help of the federal government, in places where the National Guard goes in or federal law enforcement, then things calm down. And in places where they don't, chaos reigns. It's a difficult argument for an incumbent to make, that things that are happening in his country while he is president are not his responsibility. But, you know, I talked to a longtime Trump advisor who said, there's no cognitive dissonance here. President Trump sees himself as an outsider. He's going to run as an outsider. He's the outsider here, even though he is president of the United States.
So, Amy, pick up on that. I mean, looking historically, I mean, other candidates back, Richard Nixon in the 60s and others, Republicans have tried to use this law and order argument. How successful has it been, and how hard is it for the Democrats to push back against it?
Right. And Tam was totally right that when you're an incumbent and bad things are happening on your watch, it's really hard to turn it on the other person, especially in the case when that other person happens to be Joe Biden. And he said in his speech today, you know me, do I look like a radical socialist with the soft spot for rioting? I mean, this has been the challenge for Republicans from the get-go, is in Joe Biden, they have a very difficult target. He does not sort of fit the stereotype of the kind of candidate they were hoping to run against, somebody who identifies as a socialist or somebody who would have more sympathies with some of the folks that are leading these protests and some of the riots that are going on there. So that's challenge number one. And as I said, the other challenge for the president is having a believability on the issue, or at least being seen as a broker on this issue that they can trust.
I would
That's just a tough subject.
We are, however, on President Trump's ground right now. This whole conversation is President Trump's ground.
Yeah, it was the pandemic, and now we're talking about the protest. Exactly. Tamara Keith, Amy Walter, thank you both.
You're welcome.
And we ask you to stay with us as we take a look at our August pick for NewsHour, New York Times Book Club. Now read this. But first, take a moment to hear from your local PBS station. It's a chance to offer your support, which helps to keep programs like ours on the air. Now, a look back at one of our favorite things, John Yang's conversation with stage and screen legend Julie Andrews. This encore presentation is part of our arts and culture series, Canvas.
Both Sound of Music and Mary Poppins were touchstones in
my youth. Actually, they were in mine, too.
And mine as well.
And yours as well. And then talking to my colleagues, they're showing their children.
Yes, isn't that phenomenal? I mean, that's a bonus and that you just don't expect. But those timeless, good musicals, and they were so beautifully made.
Andrew's legendary career includes the stage, movies, TV, concerts, and recordings. She's a Dame Commander of the British Empire and has 6 Golden Globes, 3 Grammys, 2 Emmys, an Oscar, and a Kennedy Center honor. Andrews and Hamilton, a professional writer and arts educator, have written more than 30 books for children and young adults. They wrote Homework, a memoir of my Hollywood years as a teen.
Emma, as you were growing up, were there movies or projects of your mother's that were particular favorites?
Well, I was pretty much there most of the time on set for most of the films. I couldn't sit through The Sound of Music for years without weeping, because anytime I saw my mother cry on film, I burst into tears myself.
Yes, so she'd suddenly say, I'm just going out for a little bit, and blinking very furiously.
Yeah. But I have to say, probably now among my favorites of her films is Hawaii.
I'm pleased to make your acquaintance, Reverend Hale.
I think her performance in it is so different than many of her other films and so strong.
Of the 3 early ones you made, Americanization of Emily, one of your favorites.
It's the virtue of war that's the fraud, not war itself. It's the valor and the self-sacrifice and the goodness of war that needs the exposing.
It's a very timely theme, more than ever maybe, about the folly and excess of war and the needlessness of it.
Writing about your early days in vaudeville, you talked about the contrast between the glamorous appearance of life in the theater and the rather shabby reality of it backstage.
Yes.
And you give us a lot of examples in your movie making, particularly of that wonderful opening scene of Sound of Music. The camera discovers you on a mountaintop.
Yes, but actually being photographed by a cameraman hanging from the side of a helicopter. I kept being dashed to the ground by the downdraft from the jet engines. But every time I came up, you know, with grass and hay all over me. The hills fill
my heart. One lyric in the movie that you never quite got.
There was just one tiny line that I really didn't know how to sing. And I just thought the best thing to do, since I'm out in the wild and so on, just say, you know, sing through the night like a lark who is learning to pray. I go to the hills and carry on very fast after that. Like a lark who is learning to
pray. For her very first film, Mary Poppins, she won the Oscar.
For a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down, the medicine go down, medicine go down.
Just I know, a stunning surprise. I didn't expect to. And I really thought for a while that maybe it was given to me as a kind of welcome to Hollywood gesture. And what a lucky, lucky moment in my life.
The book focuses on the importance of family. Emma, the child of her first marriage to theater director Tony Walton, two stepchildren, Jennifer and Jeffrey, from her second marriage to noted film director, writer, producer Blake Edwards, and the two daughters she and Edwards adopted, Amelia and Joanna. Edwards, who died in 2010, directed Andrews in seven movies, including Ten and Victor Victoria. La, 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 la.
I love the unity that it provides. And working with Blake, I felt so very safe in his embrace, so to speak. And I knew that I didn't have to worry about a thing, but on camera. But just sticking together, traveling together, being together, it's why home in homework is there, because making a home, keeping family together means so much to me.
There's a sweet story in the book of when she flew in to surprise me for my 15th birthday. And she only left about 2 weeks prior to go back to work in Europe. And I came home from school and discovered her sitting on my bed, completely wrapped in crepe paper, I guess it was. And then I burst into tears, happy tears.
Yet not all the memories are happy.
Blake was a very depressive personality and yet devastatingly funny. But when he was in a bad way, it was very sad.
You felt the need to make things better, to make people happy.
Well, it's sort of my job in a way, John, if you think about it. Being on stage all my life, it's about hopefully giving joy, and I love to do it.
In her next book, Andrews also expects to deal with the emotional impact of losing her singing voice after throat surgery in 1997, though she says she can't discuss the procedure itself.
Unfortunately, I can't talk about it since it was part of my agreement in a settlement where I gave all the settlement to charity and so on, but it was a devastating time in my life.
Welcome, my greenies.
She's still working, though, recently creating and appearing in Julie's Green Room on Netflix.
To the stage!
To the stage!
The children's series, produced with the Jim Henson Company, is about puppets staging their own musical under the watchful eye of Andrews, now herself a grandmother of 10 and great-grandmother of 3. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm John Yang in New York.
Before we go, the latest from our Now Read This book club. Our August pick was Beijing Payback, a fast-paced thriller about a young American's discovery of his late father's involvement in a vast Chinese crime syndicate. You can find the full conversation between Jeffrey Brown and author Daniel Nia online. But let's listen to an excerpt.
That's a key sort of feeling in the United States is we're individuals and we have our own desires and we want to do what we want to do. But at the same time, we're subject to the gravitational pull of history and of our families. And so everything that we think and feel and everything that we enjoy, all the privileges we enjoy, are produced by our parents for us and our societies for us. And Victor is discovering that. He's discovering that he's linked inextricably to his father's past. And of course, there's a sense in which this is a metaphor for the relationship between the United States and China. We buy a lot of things from China. Every time we buy cheap things at the store that were manufactured overseas, we're participating in the biggest economic relationship in the world that has immense consequences for everyone who's involved.
Daniel Nia, the book is Beijing Payback. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.